Barbarian Tribes of Rome, Germanic Feuds and Punishments. Now, the blood feud I've already mentioned in connection with the practice of war. To allow private war was to go unchecked would soon have brought disaster upon the community. One means of avoiding the ultimate consequences of unlimited feuding was the establishment of the Wehrgeld, a sum of money which could be paid to the injured party for damage done to person or property. Originally, it was just to the person only, as the word indicates, actually means man compensation. The Wehrgeld was regulated according to a fixed scale. So much for a free man, so much for a slave, so much for an arm, and so on. The amount of compensation, for such it was, rather than a fine, varied according to place and time. Damage or destruction of property was also regulated according to a fixed scale, or according to a sum determined by the local or general thing or assembly of freemen. This arrangement worked fairly well as a general rule, although we hear much more about it in the writings of the Anglo-Saxons and the Icelanders. The Icelanders seem to have developed a passion for going to law, and most of the time of the general assembly was spent straightening out quarrels and disputes, not always successfully either, for the parties to the dispute could refuse to accept the decision and could then take the matter into their own hands, which usually meant an outbreak of violence. When the private feuds could not be settled by arrangement and payment of money, and when they threatened to involve whole communities in conflict, the General Assembly took the matter in hand, and often one of the two parties, the one held responsible for the trouble, was declared an outlaw and forced to leave the country. This was a very common occurrence in Iceland. Erik the Red, the discoverer of Greenland, was required to leave Iceland. Outlawry among the Germanic people must have been about the same devastating effect upon the individual as excommunication in the Middle Ages. Outlawry, Wehrgeld, and private feuds were all means of settling quarrels. There were also crimes against community, and in any community which is not archaic, there are ways and means of dealing with such deeds. Certain offenses were punishable by death. Such were treason, cowardice in the face of the enemy, desertion, secret murder, injurious magic practices, robbing of one's fellow tribesmen. The expression secret murder requires comment. In the case of a private quarrel which resulted in the death of one of the parties, the survivor was not accused of murder if he had at once announced what he had done. That was a private act of revenge for injury, or an act of justice according to the established custom. But a secret, unannounced murder was in an entirely different category and became a crime against the community. Severe punishment for robbery is quite understandable, since there was no police force and private property was completely unguarded. Treason, cowardice in the face of the enemy, and desertion from the ranks in time of battle require no explanation, since modern practices differ very little from the former times. There were ways of proving the guilt or innocence of the accused. One was for the accused to get a sufficient number of relatives and friends to swear an oath to his innocence. This was not as simple as it seems. The swearing of this oath meant a sharing in responsibility, which might be, in the Icelandic chronicles, often was a serious matter indeed. Perhaps a classical example of the sharing of responsibility by oath-taking is the Chanson de Roland, where the relatives of Ganelon are involved in the punishment of his treason against the emperor. There is no doubt that we have here the survival of the old Frankish and therefore Germanic customs. But when both sides to the dispute had plenty of supporters who were willing to be sworn, then another means of settlement had to be devised. The later trial by ordeal may have been one of the methods recourse to, as we are familiar with, but the individual who was accused had to be in desperate circumstances to appeal to this judgment, or had to be able to make quite sure that the ordeal could be undergone without fatal results. Common forms of ordeal, if one can judge from later practices, were by water and by fire. If the accused, for example, could plunge his hand in the boiling water without injury, or could pick up a rod of red-hot iron, it seems quite evident that the tribal gods were not offended, and therefore the accused was innocent. If the accused, when thrown in the water, sank, as was normal, then he was innocent. If he floated, he was guilty, the idea being that waters refused to take a guilty man. Prompt measures presumably had to be taken to rescue the innocent man who sank before it was too late. But we are not told what happened in such cases. Another method was trial by combat. This was a community-regulated matter. The theory was that the gods would grant victory to the innocent party, not to the one who was stronger and more adept in the use of arms. This practice was continued into the days of chivalry, and even then received the blessing of the church, again acting on the principle that right will prevail. Ganelon's final doom was sealed, it will be recalled, when he lost this trial by combat. In some cases, the gods made the correct decision, but we can only indulge in speculation as to how many times justice was blind. Crimes against a community were regarded as crimes against tribal deities, and it is therefore quite logical that the representatives of the deities, the priests, should take charge in the determination of guilt or innocence, and should also carry out or supervise punishment. According to Tacitus, the usual punishments were by hanging or burial in the moors. More burials of the 3rd and 4th century would indicate that this form of punishment was still in force in later times. The hanging of the guilty was regarded as an offering to the gods, and the burial in the moors was also evidently a symbolic act, a complete removal of the criminal from contact with the living. This would also be the reason why in moor burials the victims were often bound, to prevent the spirit of the dead from further troubling the living. Whether these unfortunate individuals were put to death before burial, or whether they were buried alive, is an open question. Many of them were probably buried alive. In some cases, the accused were buried fully clothed, and this has been of great value in determining the nature of clothing worn and the technique of manufacture, since the waterlogged moors made preservation much more likely than in earlier graves. Now, you can see a lot of this discussion in an interesting document, and that is the Salic Law of the Franks, put out by Clovis, which has the separation of the classes, it has the punishments, it has how many people would have to be brought forward to get you out by backing you up, and money payments and all sorts of other stuff. So look up S-A-L-I-C, Salic Law. That should be easily available on the internet, and it's quite fascinating. Now, next time, we're going to put a couple of short objects together, so for example, slavery, gambling, and relations between the sexes. Now, the source for this, The Germanic People, Their Origin, Expansion, and Culture by Owens, Civilization of the Celts by Launay, Civilization of the Steppes by Conrad. So I hope you enjoyed that. As always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.